Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're going to take a look back on the 2018 Save Youth Summit in Raleigh, North Carolina, with someone who played a very special role in the event, Mark Barden, co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, which hosted the event and shared a number of resources with attendees related to the organization's Know the Signs programs. Then we're going to shout out every 2018 Relay for Life happening across Connecticut this year and hear from an American Cancer Society organizer and a couple of passionate Relay volunteers about these important fund and awareness-raising happenings across the state and around the country to help achieve a world without cancer. Then we're going to wrap up talking with the director of the Children's Environmental Health Center at Mount Sinai and why the critical children's and public health research being done there is benefiting from the 10th annual Greening Our Children Benefit Luncheon happening in Greenwich later this week. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Today's Alpha Community Services YMCA is a full-service agency serving more than 1,200 homeless clients each year in the community, providing shelter and permanent supportive housing in what is Bridgeport's largest family emergency shelter system. You can help their efforts and feel good doing it at the 17th annual Walk to End Homelessness on Saturday, May 19th at Captain's Cove in Bridgeport. Registration starts at 8:30 a.m. and the walk begins promptly at 9:30. If you'd like to find out more, get details and put a team together, or just walk yourself, call 203-366-2809 or click on cccymca.org. Well, on April 21st, following the second national school walkout and the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, students from around the country attended Sandy Hook Promise's full-day Save the Youth Summit in Raleigh, North Carolina. Here, a couple of weeks on, we are back in Newtown with Mark Barden. He, along with Nicole Hockley, co-founded Sandy Hook Promise since the tragic loss of his son Daniel, one of the first graders at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Mark has dedicated himself to bringing people together to find sensible solutions that will prevent future tragedies and spare other families the pain of losing a child to gun violence. You've seen him standing beside world leaders, presidents, students, activists, and very, very proud and pleased to call him a friend of mine. Mark, thanks for joining us today and talking about this exciting event that you folks just pulled off in Raleigh, North Carolina. First of all, let's talk some backstory. At what point in the relatively short history of Sandy Hook Promise did you decide you wanted to do a national event that was exclusively an arena for young people to gather? Because it seems like it's an idea that was way ahead of its time, but that has suddenly arrived.
Yeah, thank you, John. So we partnered with the SAVE Clubs, which is Students Against Violence Everywhere, that was actually the SAVE Clubs started, I think, 29 years ago in North Carolina, and we joined forces with them about a year ago. The SAVE Clubs have been having an annual summit for many years now. Mm-hmm. And so as part of this coalition of SAVE and Sandy Hook Promise, we jointly hosted this this youth summit as part of the tradition that the SAVE Clubs had already been doing. It was an incredible event. It kind of stretched across Friday and Saturday. And we had over 400 students and their adult mentors with us, representing, I think, at least 22 states. From across the United States, a packed University of North Carolina auditorium and auxiliary rooms as well, and the activism, the level of emotion and engagement, and information that was present and shared was just beautiful, inspiring, and at times overwhelming.
I imagine an interesting touch point for you coming off of this tsunami of activism post Parkland, and if it could possibly inject any more energy into the effort, I imagine it did.
It absolutely did, John. And you know, as you said, we're seeing youth activism at a peak nationally now, and The momentum seems to be continuing, which is great to see. I've witnessed it personally in my own family, even before the horrible tragedy in Parkland. My little daughter Natalie has joined the Newtown Youth Action Alliance here, and has started to become active. Has been raising her voice for the first time really since the tragedy that took her little brother over 5 years ago. But now, with the surge of youth activism in the wake of the tragedy in Parkland, she finds herself at the epicenter of this, and as such has been requested to become involved in all kinds of activities around this. But she did have her debut speaking event at the summit. It was her first time addressing a large crowd and doing a public speaking with remarks that she wrote completely herself. As a proud dad, I was just absolutely overwhelmed by her eloquence and her accurate information. And so I'm so proud to see my little daughter involved with this youth movement. She's 16 years old, and I think she has a very powerful voice to share.
Excellent. A lot of these young people have, through no fault or probably desire of their own, been thrust sort of into the middle of a political spotlight as well. As you're interacting in your circles of influence in Washington and state capitals, tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from the people first who share your mission, and if you're hearing from any, those who maybe didn't share your mission until they saw this incredible groundswell, the likes of which we really haven't seen since, like, the Vietnam War. I cannot remember any level of activism amongst young people, especially, these are not the 16 to 21-year-olds of the Woodstock generation. These are the 12 to 20-year-olds.
Yeah, you're right. It's a large swath of demographic to be reckoned with, for sure. And it's like nothing we've seen in this country. And you're right. And you know, these kids are the stakeholders of their own future. It's heartbreaking to see that just to be kids, just to be able to go out to a concert, to their place of worship, to school, even that they have to actively advocate for their own safety. It's heartbreaking to see that. But that's where we are now, and they're not taking no for an answer. They're not backing down. They're informed. They're articulate. And I really believe that this is the catalyst moment of a movement that is going to change the future of our country. And to your point, folks who have already been involved in this conversation and are trying to affect positive change are so inspired by the youth activism that it's generating a ripple effect across constituencies and age groups that we're seeing adults who are now re-incentivized to join to double down on their own efforts. And now we're seeing more constituency groups and more adult engagement as well, folks who were not previously being engaged, who are inspired by this really youth-led movement that is kind of borrowing from the groundwork that we have laid in the last 5 years and in the years before that with other organizations. So I think it's all culminating and coming together in this very powerful, widespread, true social movement.
Are you seeing situations where political leaders that you have reached out to in the past who have politely declined are now seemingly a little more receptive or a little more open? Are you getting the sense that those who were against you are now sort of seeing the future, and the future is them without a job if they don't create some symbiosis with this young activist demographic?
Yeah, I definitely see that, John. I see elected officials are taking the cues from the public, as they have always done, and this has reached a tipping point now where they realize that their very jobs are on the line with regard how they vote on this issue. And yeah, we're definitely seeing that. My organization, Sandy Hook Promise, has always taken a non-political or bipartisan or maybe nonpartisan approach to this. And we talk about prevention. We talk about school safety. Those are not polarizing issues. Those are issues that, regardless of your political orientation, you can get on board with. Everybody wants to protect our children. Everybody wants to make our community safer. Mm-hmm. And so we have always enjoyed bipartisan support for our initiatives. There have been in the past when we advocate for gun safety issues that relate to access, like background checks or an extreme risk protection order, we have had folks who feel like it's their obligation to vote against that because it's in conflict with their traditional party position. That is even changing now, and we're seeing governors and states across the country supporting robust gun violence prevention legislative packages. So we're absolutely watching the future change right in front of our very eyes.
Excellent. And probably not nowhere more evident than at the April 21st Save Youth Summit in Raleigh, North Carolina. It was your early on participation in this initiative, which I'm sure will continue. Let's talk about that event and do a little bit of a look back in the time that we have left. You and Nicole both attended. Your daughter was there, as you said. It was a busy time. But a lot of what Sandy Hook Promise was engaged in at the Youth Summit was their Your Say Something initiative. The Signs Program, I should say, which incorporates a number of initiatives as part of it, including a couple that were the subjects of breakout groups. Mm-hmm. So let's start with Say Something. This kind of rolled out with a very, very powerful YouTube video campaign a little over a year ago. And there's since been a second video that's been released, right?
Yeah. So Say Something is one of our four Know the Signs programs that we offer at no cost to schools and communities and youth-serving organizations across the country. And it trains kids to look for language, mostly in social media, but it could be elsewhere, of somebody who is exhibiting at-risk behavior, and then speak up to a trusted adult and get that person to the help that they need before it becomes a tragedy. And that's how we prevent, we have prevented school shootings. We have prevented suicides that way. We also offer an anonymous reporting system, which is an app that kids can make a tip, or anybody can make a tip to a call center that's staffed with trained professionals who triage that information and take the appropriate next steps. And so that's a safe place that kids can tip, can send in a tip on at-risk behavior. The folks at BBDO helped us with pro bono creative work to produce our Evan video that we just wanted people to see that these warning signs could be happening right in front of you, and you might not even notice it as you just go through your daily life, and how to look for those warning signs. And we were hoping that maybe through a social media push we could get maybe a million people to see that. And in the first 3 weeks, I think it had been viewed over 145 million times worldwide, and just continued on its trajectory from there. It has won almost every advertising award there is to win, and continues to be recorded as one of the most successful campaigns to date. So we're very proud of that piece of work. We have then subsequently released another one called Tomorrow's News, which kind of highlights the importance of saying something with an eye toward prevention. If you see or hear at-risk behavior, that you need to take the next step and get somebody help before it becomes a tragedy.
Yeah, I distinctly remember our last visit 48 hours into the first video release, where we were celebrating the 1 million, the one mm-hmm. kind of view, which was pretty exciting. But Sandy Hook Promise also plays a very, very important role in prevention and intervention, and that's where the Start With Hello campaign comes in.
That's right, John. Start With Hello is kind of near and dear to my own heart. It teaches kids behaviors that my little Daniel used to do on his own, in that he would reach out to somebody sitting alone and make sure they were okay and see if they wanted a friend. You know, as a parent, you love to hear that. But, you know, subsequently, as we've studied that behavior, we've learned how really significant it is, and that somebody who is in a position where they are socially isolated for a sustained amount of time can be at risk, at an increased risk for violent behavior or being the victim of violence. And so the Start With Hello program has all kinds of fun activities and tools and icebreakers for kids to engage in that will address social isolation and help others feel included and valued. And communicated with in a way that we know can avert future trouble. And we teach them how to recognize that everybody needs healthy alone time, and that's okay too. But those folks who are chronically always left out and made to feel invisible need to be included in the conversation, and we know that can offset future situations. Mm.
We also hear so many situations where even young peers of victims of suicide said, we saw it coming, there was mention of it, to that end, and also with an eye on prevention, Sandy Hook Promise has initiated Signs of Suicide, one of the other Know the Signs program pillars.
Right. So Signs of Suicide is the only evidence-based suicide prevention program that is actually the most effective, and we are helping to scale that as the name implies. It trains students, parents, teachers how to recognize the subtle and sometimes not so subtle warning signs of somebody who is contemplating self-harm. We have dozens of case studies where you know, high school kids will leave literally hundreds of impressions in social media about their intentions. And it tells this tragic story that leads right up to the day that somebody is tweeting and texting that I'm going to do this. And folks don't know how to intervene. They don't know if it's serious. They don't know what to do. We train folks how to do that, how to intervene safely. Again, they can use our anonymous reporting system to do that anonymously and then connect that person to the help that they need before it becomes a tragedy. So we're very proud of that program as well.
Tell us a little bit more about how the science aspect enters into the picture when you were putting this all together and the idea was to perhaps initiate some sort of a suicide prevention initiative. How does that all work to end up being unveiled as one of these main pillars of your organization's efforts?
Lots of thought, lots of research, lots of study, a lot of interviews with stakeholders across the country has gone into all of these programs. And we take all of this as a nexus, what happened in here in Sandy Hook. And each one or anyone or any combination of any of these four programs, I believe in my heart, would have or could have prevented what happened in Sandy Hook. The social isolation one, Start With Hello, the Say Something program that trains people to recognize warning signs and report on them. Any of these programs, I believe, would have potentially averted what happened in Sandy Hook. And we know that they have already averted other mass shootings and prevented suicide. So there is a lot of data, a lot of research that goes into this. A lot of it we've done on our own. We've interviewed thought leaders, all kinds of folks and stakeholders across the country. We've also had a lot of research help pro bono from McKinsey Group. Along the way, and others who have donated their time and support and resources to help us gather all the data and do all the research that is necessary to come up with these evidence-informed programs that work. And thanks to the generosity of our donors, we're able to offer them all at no cost.
How much of it is radiating out from the center, which is the Sandy Hook Promise home office here, putting the feelers out, networking, making the call to scientific experts versus those who were sort of toiling away in a dark basement, if you will, somewhere with a great idea who have learned about Sandy Hook Promise and come to say, would you consider this data or this idea that I have that seems to fit with what you folks are doing?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably an even mix of in-house outreach and research and data collection, and then others who are coming in from the field. Like, I think I have something to offer that might be of value to you guys you can put into the mix with the data and research that you're collecting now. So it's very much collaborative. And, you know, we have a national presence now. We're in all 50 states. We have trained 3.5 million students and adults in our Know the Science programs nationwide. And, you know, we continue to grow on a scale and scale at a pace that is sustainable so that we can maintain and sustain the fidelity of our programs.
Excellent. The fourth pillar of the Know the Signs initiative is safety assessment and intervention. This sounds like it's something that's more reserved for educators, professionals, counselors, and not necessarily a peer-to-peer initiative.
More so, that's right, John. It is more for the adults and for the educators. It's a tool for them to recognize warning signs and take the next steps. The safety assessment and intervention is a threat assessment model that was originally developed by the FBI in the wake of the Virginia Tech shooting, and then was adapted for a school-based model by Dr. Dewey Cornell at the University of Virginia. And we are working with him to scale this model. The safety assessment and intervention program, it develops a multidisciplinary team within the school who could be a teacher. If the school has a guidance counselor, that could be part of the team. And different folks who are different touch points to identify at-risk behavior and then address it and get that person to the resources necessary, whether it's an immediate intervention or a conversation with school staff or family later. And this model also addresses the root cause of the behavior that led to the at-risk behavior, so that so more than just treating symptomatically, it can get to the root cause and really get to the heart of the problem and get that individual the help that they need in a sustained long-term fashion.
Excellent. Folks, if you're hearing something that you'd like to learn more about, you can go to sandyhookpromise.org. That's where it all starts. You can view the videos we talked about today. You can learn about their Know the Signs program and the various initiatives that are part of it. Perhaps you'd be interested in initiating one or more of them in your community, in your school. Sandy Hook Promise stands ready to assist. As Managing Director of Sandy Hook Promise, Mark Barden leads and manages this organization, along with Nicole Hockley, who's the mother of Dylan, who was also killed at Sandy Hook. Mark is focusing, as you can hear, on policy and outreach efforts for Sandy Hook Promise and frequently serves as a spokesperson for the organization, as he did so well during our visit here today. Mark, thank you so much for all this great information, this look back on the 2018 Save Youth Summit in Raleigh, North Carolina. I trust that Sandy Hook Promise will be a key partner to that initiative and others like it going forward. Appreciate your time today, and thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure, as always.
All right. One of my favorite programs of the year is when we promote all over the state of Connecticut, the Relays for Life, a few that have already happened and many, many more that are happening way into October. We'll be shouting out each and every single relay in Connecticut during this segment. And we're going to start off with a little history and backstory and to learn a little bit about how the money that's raised at Relay for Lives go back into the community with Stephanie Balasano with the American Cancer Society here in Connecticut. Stephanie, before we start, please let me take a couple of moments to recognize several of the relays that have already happened. Relay for Life at Connecticut College, at Sacred Heart University, and at Fairfield University all happened back in April. And we also have relays coming up in the coming weeks at Westover School in Middlebury on May 20th. In West Hartford on June 9th. And then Quinnipiac University, as opposed to doing it in the springtime, they do it in the fall on September 29th. We also want to welcome folks to the relay for Stratford on June 16th. June 1st is in Southington. June 2nd, the Relay for Life of Southeastern Connecticut in Norwich. The relay in South Windsor and Vernon is happening on June 8th. And we will get to the rest of the state of Connecticut in the coming segments and make sure that we shout out each and every one. But right now, Stephanie, thanks for joining us. Great to be with you again after these many, many years of working together to promote the great work that the American Cancer Society is doing, as well as the Relays for Life. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having us on.
Yo, you're welcome. And I can't wait to meet Tina and Sue, a couple of passionate volunteers who are going to talk about their own relays in Merritt and Wallingford and in Plainville. But tell us a little bit about the backstory. It's very interesting. This started with one man on one track, I believe, in Washington State. Is that right? Or Oregon?
Yeah, no, it was in Washington. So Dr. Gordy Klatt was in Tacoma, Washington in 1985, and he is the founder and originated the idea of Relay for Life and the movement. And from there, we are here today. He started just by walking around the track for 24 hours and raised donations. And in essence, that's still what Relay for Life is today, a gathering of people within the community, raising funds and awareness for cancer across Connecticut and really across the world.
And one of the cool things about Relay is there are a few aspects of it that are universal to everyone, whether it's here in Connecticut, somewhere else in North America, or somewhere else on the globe. The Luminaria ceremony and a couple of other things are regular fixtures of relays, no matter where you're relaying. There's also some really interesting ways to get the entire community involved. This is not something that's insular to folks who are participating and they don't want anybody else going in there. This is really a community event, a gathering place wherever it happens. And a lot of the money that's raised turns right back around into the very community where that money comes from, right?
Exactly. So communities all over Connecticut, they're gathering together because we all know that everyone is affected by cancer in one way or another. So people throughout the state are really coming together to support those who have cancer, to honor those who we've lost, and to fight back against cancer that takes so much from so many. And these funds that are raised by participants in the state really help the ACS attack cancer from every angle. We do this in dozens of ways. We develop breakthrough cancer research and therapies. We work within the communities and provide programs and services to the cancer patients who need them the most. And we are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with our 1-800 number, 1-800-227-2345. This number is a crucial program to cancer patients, to anybody who just wants to give us a call day or night. We have someone live on the line ready to answer your questions.
And the other thing that's great about Relay is I remember way, way back, you know, 20 plus years ago, maybe 25 years ago when I started in Shelton, it was a 24-hour event. It started, you know, early in the day on a Saturday and ended early in the day on Sunday. But Relay for Life has kind of morphed into something that fits all communities. It can be as short as 5 or 6 or 7 hours, right? Or it can go all the way up to 24.
Yeah, so we realize too now everybody's busy and there's so many deserving causes besides the American Cancer Society and Relay for Life. So it's really up to the community and the volunteers involved to see what fits them best. So like you said, John, there's some that are a couple hours long, 5-6 hours. There's some that still go overnight. And there's some events too that we really put in the hands of the community members to develop and do their own way. And it's our do-it-yourself events that really could be adapted in any community, any area, that fits what they really need in their efforts to fight cancer.
Excellent. Before we let you go, take a quick break and then meet a couple of these passionate volunteers. Are there a couple of other things you want communities across Connecticut to know about Relay?
Yeah, so even if you've never been to a Relay for Life event, go and check it out. If it's in your community, if it's in your area, grab some friends and family. It is an unforgettable experience. We're really there to help the community and help cancer patients, their friends, their families in the fight against cancer. We welcome all cancer survivors throughout Connecticut to check out an event and join us while we honor you and honor your journey at one of our receptions and at our survivor lap. And those are two things that are at each Relay for Life event. So I really urge people throughout the state to come out and just check out an event near them. They can go to www.relayforlife.org, and you can find all of our events. Even if you know of someone in Massachusetts or Maine and you want to go up to an event up there, you can find any event that we have across the United States and join that event.
That's right. And really, if folks are listening on their podcast, podcast on iTunes or on one of our radio station websites, and they know of a relative or friend who's far-flung somewhere else, not even in the United States, where there are thousands and thousands of communities doing relays this year. It also is happening in 27 different countries, so a really, really incredible movement, and we're so glad to both be a partner and a part of the passion behind Relays for Life here in Connecticut. Stephanie Bolisano from the American Cancer Society, thanks for kicking off our program this morning. We're going to take a quick break and come back and meet a couple volunteers, so thanks for being with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. 211 Connecticut is the first and remains one of the more than 200 211 services located throughout the country, working to connect Connecticut residents to the help they need for more than 40 years. 211 Connecticut is excited to announce the release of a new website feature, My 211 Account. My 211 account makes it easier for people to access the resources they need, create unlimited customized resource lists, save important resources to access at a later time, and helps in sharing, printing, or emailing your resource lists. Visit www.211ct.org to sign up for a free My 211 account, or if you need a connection to help and services in your community, just call 211 or go to 211ct.org. Well, the best part of the program for me when we promote our statewide Relays for Life are meeting the folks who are feet on the ground and hands-on volunteers for the events. Thanks for sticking with us to continue this segment on Connecticut's Relays for Life. We're going to meet a couple of those folks in just a couple minutes. But in the meantime, we do want to continue our shout-outs of all of the relays that are happening here in Connecticut in the coming weeks and months. The Relay for Life of Bethany Orange in Woodbridge is coming up on May 19th, as is the Relay for Life of Ellington, Tolland, and North Central Connecticut. The Relay of Life of Fairfield is coming up on the 9th, and one day before that, on June 8th, the Relay for Life of Bristol. May 19th is going to be the Relay for Life of the Farmington Valley. On June 9th, the Relay for Life of Greater Danbury. On the 2nd of June, the Relay for Life of Greater Middletown. And also on June 2nd, my hometown relay in Greater Waterbury. Right now, we want to welcome Tina Rodriguez. She's with the Relay for Life of Meriden Wallingford. And Tina, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So when did you first hear about Relay? How did you get into this whole crazy thing?
Well, I heard about Relay back in 2005. My sister was a survivor then, and she invited me to the Meriden Wallingford Relay for Life back in 2005.
Mm-hmm. And it got a hold of you and hasn't let go ever since?
Well, what happened was, little did I know that that would be the first and the last relay that I would attend with my sister. Sadly, she passed away January of 2006. So then I didn't know about Relay, and I was at a health fair event. I work for Mid-State Medical, where I do community outreach for on cancer, mm-hmm. breast cancer. And while I was at one of my health fairs, I met Lynn Kippett, which was there with Relay for Life. It brought me back to, you know, brought back memories of my sister. So I inquired. They were having the relay 3 weeks later, I believe, and I asked her, how can I start a team? And I had 2.5 weeks in plan in my relay, but because I facilitated a Hispanic support group at the hospital, I went back, spoke to the women from the support group, and they all knew my sister because she was a part of the support group.
Yeah.
And they agreed to start a team with me, and we're 8 years strong this year.
How many folks with you on the team this year in Meriden Wallingford?
For my personal team or
yeah,
in
on
general?
Your, no, on your
My personal
on your team,
we're, I believe right now registered. I have 25. It's so hard to get them registered, but I'm working on it. But usually there's about 40 of us.
Oh, great.
Relaying, yes.
And do you know roughly how big the Meriden Wallingford Relay is? You get about 1,000 people there?
Yes, we do. Oh. I'm pretty sure we do.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Good. Well, you're also, you know, being in the outreach situation and particularly with an energy toward the Hispanic community in and around the mid-state region, the service area of the hospital there. Tell us a couple of the most important things that for people are listening, because Relay is not just kind of an insular event. It's not like everybody just kind of goes in and closes the door and makes it happen and then opens the door and goes home in the morning. This is a community and awareness raising event. What are a couple of the most important things in the people that you are serving as an outreach provider? What are the most important things that you want to tell them about cancer awareness and prevention?
Well, one of the things I want to say is to please get involved. We need volunteers. Like you said, it doesn't happen overnight. There's planning going on. We start in September, you know, meeting to make this happen in the month of May the following year. So it's so important to just get involved. Don't wait till cancer hits home, you know, to start finding out about it. While I'm out doing outreach in the community, I ask people, do you know about Relay? I'm always talking about it. And so many people still don't know what Relay for Life is. And it's just so important to get involved, you know, find out about it. The American Cancer Society, they have so much information to offer on everything, you know, getting ready when a person is first diagnosed, you know, up until through treatments and then services that they provide after the fact. It's just amazing at all the services that are provided. Mm-hmm. So definitely it's so important to get involved and just help out. We need the help.
And it doesn't, if folks can't do a team or be involved in Relay because of family or work or other commitments, there's loads of other volunteer opportunities to support those in the community who are surviving cancer, like giving them rides to therapy.
Exactly.
And doctor's appointments, or you know, doing other volunteerism.
Correct. Yes. There are other services. Like I said, you don't have to start a team. I ask people just come and, you know, especially people that have never heard about it. I encourage them to come down to the field. Just come and, because when my sister invited me, I'm thinking, oh, it's a cancer event. I'm thinking it's going to be a gloomy, you know, sad event. But when I walked on the field, the energy was so powerful. I can still remember. It's like, I was wowed. That's the word that I regarding the Relay.
Yeah.
Because it was people celebrating life, you know, it was a beautiful event, and I'm hooked.
Yeah, that's a great
but
description.
But yeah, there are services, you know, I mean, we need people helping set up in the morning, helping the relayers, you know, the teams set up their tents. So there are a lot of volunteer opportunities for them.
Very good.
They don't have to be in a team, you know, they can just walk or, you know, just volunteer helping with the Luminaria tent. There's a lot of volunteer opportunities.
Very good. Well, folks, if you want to learn more about opportunities in your community, of course, Tina Rodriguez's Relay for Life of Meriden Wallingford is coming up here on the 18th of May, I believe. And so you'll be able to find her there. But there are relays happening in dozens of Connecticut communities. We already ran a list of a few more, and we'll do some before we pick up with our next guest. But in the meantime, Tina, I'm horribly sorry for your loss of your sister, but in some ways, you know, the loss that you suffered has given you a new energy and power to make a difference and help in the lives and perhaps help save the lives of others who are battling cancer in your communities and in your region where you live. So thank you so much for the great work you're doing with the Relay for Life of Meriden Wallingford, and I wish you many more years of success, and hopefully one of these days we'll be talking and you'll say, oh, my team is 100 now. And I'll say, oh, I remember when it was just 40.
That sounds good. Okay. By the way, my team is Latin Mamas. Males or females, not just the reason we got that name was because I initiated, you know, from the Hispanic support group They were all women, but yeah.
Excellent.
But we're 8 years strong, and we're doing good.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Good luck with your relay coming up on the 18th of May.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye. Now we're going to pick up with another very special guest, the co-event leader of the Relay for Life of Plainville. Sue Root is on the line with us. But before we chat with her, we want to shout out way down the road in October, October 13th, the Relay for Life of Greater Windham County out in Mansfield. That's happening. The Relay for Life of Haddam Killingworth on June 23rd, the Hamden North Haven Relay on June 9th, and coming up in just a little while, on May 19th, the relay up in Litchfield County. Naugatuck Valley is holding their Relay for Life in Shelton on June 2nd, as is Fairfield on June 2nd. And the Relay for Life of New London County and the Seashore area in Groton is coming up on June 30th. The Relay for Life of Newington on June 15th, the day after, is the Relay for Life of Newtown over at Newtown High School in Sandy Hook. On May 19th, the Relay for Life of Northeastern Connecticut way out in Brooklyn. And that brings me to June 2nd and the big day for co-event leader Sue Root, who's on the line with us in her relay in Plainville. Sue, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, John. Thanks for having me.
So tell me your relay story. How did you first learn about this activity, and how long was it between when you knew what a relay was and when you became a part of one?
So I've been participating in relay for now for about 15 years. I first found out about relay events through my employer and participated in that way. And then with a friend a few years later, found out about the Plainville event, started participating with her team, and eventually joined our leadership council and haven't left since. So I've been there for about 8 years now.
Excellent. Did you graduate from just a kind of a frontline volunteer up to the co-event leader, or did you sort of jump right into the management end of things?
No, I actually, it's been small steps. Once I joined our event leadership team, I started doing as our luminary chair, so in charge of all the luminaria that you see around the tracks at night, and then I moved from there right into our event leadership.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because for almost every single person I have ever talked to in the past 25 or 30 years about relay, they will always, talk about the great times and the games and the food and the passion and the magic and sort of the life-affirming energy that goes on at relay. But really, one of the most intense and touching moments of the Relay for Life, and it's a tradition all around the world, wherever relays are, is this Luminaria event. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and why that you think that's such a special moment of relay?
The Luminaria events really are the most special and the most touching, as far as I'm concerned. The Luminarias that light our track overnight represent the people that we know in our lives that have been touched by cancer, those we've lost, those we're remembering that night, but those who are still battling. And it really encapsulates everything that relay is about. It's about spending the time to remember the people that we love, to think about their fight, and really to keep striving to move forward and to hopefully end this horrible disease someday.
Yeah. And tell me, you're involved in the management. Have you, or do you this year have a team that you're part of?
I am. I'm a member of a team that really started as a bunch of close friends. We have close to 60 members just on our team at this point, and it's really evolved from some friends to getting our kids involved. We started with some soccer moms, really, and have grown to one of the largest teams that participate in the Plainville Relay, and I'm really proud. It's proud to be a member of that team, as I am to be a part of our leadership.
Which team is it?
We're I'm a member of Team Survivor. So we came up with that name a few years ago, and we're really close on that night, and all throughout the year we do things to celebrate Relay.
Yeah, that's another thing. Our prior guest, Tina Rodriguez, up in Meriden, Wallingford, she made it a point to say that usually people come home on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning after a 12 or a 24-hour relay, and they catch some sleep, and virtually within a couple of days, they're almost thinking about next year's relay, and the planning begins again. So this is really a 365-day-a-year mission for those like you, Sue, who are so passionate about Relays for Life. Here in Connecticut, wherever you may be listening, around the country and literally around the world, where Relay for Life has been making such a difference and being the main fundraiser for the American Cancer Society, as well as one of the prime cancer awareness raisers in individual communities here around Connecticut. So we really want to thank you, Sue, for your activities and what you've been doing. And is there any other message that you have for folks who are listening out there who may have heard there's a relay in their community but may not have gone? Because these events, they're not, as we said in the previous interview, these aren't insular. People who are members don't just go in and close the door and nobody else is allowed. This is really something that throws its arms open to every single person in the community, because virtually everyone's been touched by cancer, right?
Absolutely. And John, I think that's an important message. People don't realize that the events are open to everyone. We're members of your community, so come out and join us. Find out what Relay is like, and just see for yourself all the entertainment. There's games and food and all of that, but it's more about experiencing the day. And we find that the more people that come out and visit us, the more members that we have the following year that want to participate in our fundraising events.
Excellent. Well, it was great to meet you, and good luck with your event in Plainville, and for all of the future events, I'm sure that you'll be bringing your passion to. And Team Survivor, I give you guys a big thumbs up and a round of applause, as well as all the volunteers for the Relay of Life of Plainville, where you will be a co-event leader this year. Sue Root, thanks so much. Great to talk with you folks. Don't forget, if you want to find out where there's a relay near you, all you need to do is go to the American Cancer Society website or your favorite search engine and put in Relay for Life and your hometown name, and you will find out where to go to get involved, whether it's one that's coming up in just the next few weeks, later on in the summer or fall, or maybe for 2019. Sue, great to meet you. Thanks again. Well, we're going to wrap up the program this morning talking about youths and taking care of their health. And that means supporting a very important upcoming event that's happening down in Greenwich this Wednesday, May 9th. It is the 10th anniversary Greening Our Children Benefit Luncheon that's celebrating how Mount Sinai Children's Environmental Health Center is working to improve the lives of children for over a decade. We are so pleased to welcome on the line this morning Dr. Robert O. Wright. He is with the Ethel Wise. He is the Ethel H. Wise Professor and Chair at the Department of Environmental Medicine and Public Health, and the Director of the Children's Environmental Health Center at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Wright, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you folks have been doing there at Mount Sinai to date that is really making a change in how both medical professionals and communities are responding to environmental concerns and utilizing the research and work that you're doing to protect and improve children's and community health.
So, we're environmental medicine program, so we're very interested in environment defined broadly. So we're interested in chemicals, we're interested in nutrition, we're interested in exercise. And one of the reasons why we're so focused on this is in the last 20 years, there's been a huge emphasis on genomics and understanding genes, and we've sort of forgotten the really important role that environment plays in our health. And in the last 2 to 3 years, that's really been sort of a ground shift in the research, where researchers are starting to recognize that if all we measure is genetics, we're really missing a huge piece of the puzzle. And there's a movement now actually to understand how environment shapes health, how environment interacts with genetics. And we've really been on the forefront of that because we have a really big head start. And the new field that we're sort of leading in is called exposomics. So the exposome is all the environmental factors that you're exposed to from the time you're conceived to the time you die, which is sort of an analog to the genome, which is all the genetic factors that are inside your body. So we're trying to understand how environment shapes your growth, shapes your development, shapes the way your brain works, how healthy your heart is later on in life, all those factors. There's a big environmental role, and that's really what we're focused on, is understanding that role.
Well, one of the exciting things about this upcoming event, as I imagine has been in at least some, if not all, of the years past, is that you are providing grants to young researchers who really have passion and energy behind this same cause. Can you tell us a little bit about that granting program and, sort of encapsulate maybe some of the important work that's been done so far, and tell us a little bit about what you know of the grantees who are going to be attending the luncheon this week?
Yeah, one of the really rewarding aspects of work, particularly in recent years, is as there's been more interest in environment and in the world environment plays, we've been able to secure funding both from the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, but also from some corporate partners such as the Honest Company. And we're now able to provide pilot funding to young investigators that are trying to get their careers jump-started. And so Honest has been a really great partner in that regard, helping us to do that. And so two of the grantees are, one's named is Jeanette Stagoni, and the other is Eric DeWater, and they're doing research on how environment shapes health. Jeanette is actually studying the exposome, so she's trying to measure as many environmental factors as possible and try to rank order the ones that are most important in predicting brain development. And Eric is actually doing MRI scans on children and relating them to environmental exposures to see how changes that you can see in an MRI scan of the brain actually may be related to past environmental exposures, so we can have an idea of how the environment shapes brain development.
Mm-hmm. This is all part of something that is, and I mean, there's new discoveries happening in the world of science and medicine virtually every minute, never mind every day. But this field of it's exposomics, is that what we're calling sort of this holistic look at both the physical young people and the environment in which they are living and playing and going to school?
So there's actually been some recent research that shows that environmental factors that you experience as a child are actually predictive of health problems that you have when you're an adult or even when you're elderly. So things like heart disease, whether or not you're going to have a heart attack or a stroke, a lot of the risk factors that actually predict that are things that happen to you as a child. And that means if we're going to prevent adult diseases, we actually have to start in childhood, and we have to have a better understanding of what those environmental factors are that actually lead to heart disease when you're 40, 50, 60 years old, what they are when you're a child, and how we can actually prevent them when you're a child. So a lot of the work that we're doing is actually going to really help our children and our grandchildren, not just today, but also 40, 50, 60 years from now. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that we actually start this work now. And there's actually a large body of literature that actually shows us, in fact, there's whole societies that are based on these recent findings. It's often referred to as DOHAD, which refers to developmental origins of health and disease. Mm-hmm. So this idea that a lot of diseases, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, heart disease, strokes, even certain cancers, have their origins in environmental factors that happened to us as children or even when our mothers were pregnant with us.
Wow. It's incredible to think that something that may have come into the mother's body while the child was in utero can come back to haunt them in their senior years, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. But I imagine one of the other huge challenges that you have in the last couple minutes that we have, Dr. Wright, is as the folks and your colleagues and the researchers with the Children's Environmental Health Center continue to find and define ways to help protect and prevent these illnesses from happening, whether it's in children or later in life, the rest of the world is inventing new toxins and new threats that are kind of coming onto the scene that you have to kind of counter against as you find that they're beginning to play a role in possibly affecting children's and public health.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why we're so focused on exposomics is that it's sort of like genomics. So in genomics, you measure all the genetic variants inside someone's DNA, and you try to rank order the ones that seem to be important for predicting health effects. So in exposomics, we're doing something similar. We're trying to measure all the environmental factors. We're trying to measure social factors. We're trying to measure nutrition, and we're trying to measure chemicals. And we're developing assays that actually can measure thousands of chemicals simultaneously, so that we can rank order the ones that are that look more important than the other ones. And the reason why that's important is even though there may be 100,000 chemicals in industrial production in the United States, there's probably only about 50 that we actually have really good data on. And those same 50 are the ones that we keep studying over and over again. We know diseases are becoming more and more common. Asthma is becoming more common. Autism is becoming more common. ADHD is becoming more common. So it's not those 50 chemicals that we've been studying, because most of them, because of that research, are actually decreasing in prevalence, you know, in industrial use. So you know, we're probably missing, we know we're missing a big piece of the picture. And by measuring thousands of chemicals all at once and trying to rank order them, we're going to actually be able to move the field forward much, much faster than if we did a study looking at one or two chemicals at a time, which is sort of the traditional approach to research. We're trying to measure thousands of chemicals simultaneously and try to rank order those ones that are more important. Many of these chemicals are chemicals that have never been studied before, even though they're in industrial use. You know, the old way of doing research, you know, you do one chemical at a time, and if there's 100,000 chemicals, it's virtually impossible to scan all of them. So what we're trying to do is, you know, sort of invert the role of research and actually try to measure all the chemicals as much, or as many of them as we can assay. So there's a lot of technological issues in measuring all of them. We're trying to work through those. So there's a lot of research that has to be done just to be able to eventually do this. But the idea is getting closer and closer to reality. And, you know, even in genetics, you know, we can measure the entire genome now. We can sequence it. But, you know, 15 years ago, that was impossible. It was only possible for, like, several millions of dollars. Now it's only a couple hundred dollars if you go to Ancestry.com or 23andMe.
Right.
And I think that's what's going to happen in exposomics in 10 or 15 years. We're going to see technological advances, and eventually you're going to be able to measure all of these chemicals simultaneously at once, as long as we keep the movement going for the research.
Well, then that comes down to calling people out to this event or to support the cause. The 10th anniversary Greening Our Children Benefit Luncheon is coming up Wednesday, May 9th. The silent auction and meet and greet starts at 11 a.m. It goes till 2 p.m. at the Greenwich Country Club. It's the 10th anniversary Greening Our Children Benefit, supporting the great work of the Children's Environmental Health Center and the many ways the center is changing how we think about children's health. If you want to find out more information about that, you can go to ICON, that's ICAHN.MSSM.EDU, and look for ways to get your tickets to the 10th anniversary luncheon. We want to thank our guest this morning, Dr. Robert Wright. He is the Ethel Wise Professor and Chair of the Department of Environmental Medicine and Public Health and the Director of the Children's Environmental Health Center at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Wright, thank you for a quick but very informative chat this morning, and good luck with the event and the work that you're doing. Hopefully we'll talk again soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.